nice perspective to bring to bear on the whole ballot.
Mm-hmm.
And I think from an outsider's point of view, you look at the valley and what you see now is the ski industry and the new people it's brought in and, you know, those kind of changes.
Well, I wondered just how long the ski industry will be here, though. I wondered. I wondered sometimes if the ski business went out, what would happen to the state? Because they get a tremendous amount of revenue, of course. And, of course, taxes in our towns have gone up tremendously. When you get into the education part of it, I feel just like this. I don't think they're getting one bit better education now than they did years ago. I can remember in the Munn Schoolhouse down here, I was down there for 2 years. We had a teacher that had, well, they had about 30 children in the school and went from first grade to eighth grade. And she taught the whole business, one teacher. And I think most of them knew how to do simple problems, mathematics pretty well. At least they learned how to read and write, and in geography pretty well, in history, those practical things. I think they're better educated in some ways than they are today. I think we've got away from the fundamentals. I notice when I go up here to school, when they opened up here for the new edition, you didn't see anything on the bulletin boards of exams or problems or anything like that. You didn't see that. All you see is the kids of where they painted something. And that's about all you see. And you just wonder when you go in there, is that all they're teaching? Now, I'm going to give you an example. Several years ago, we had I'm not going to give the name, before the Newtons come here, the party owned the place over here, and they had a daughter who was in the sixth grade. And she come up here and come to me one day, and she says, well, we're having a bike-a-thon, and she says, it's for charity purposes. And she says, for every mile that I go, what will you contribute? I says, I'll give you a dollar a mile. So she went off, and she come back late that afternoon. She come back, she says, well, I went 28 miles. I says, okay. I says, what do I owe you? Mr. Wallace, I don't know. Well, now, I says, I told you I'd give you a dollar for every mile you went. Now, I says, what's that figure? She says, I don't know. Well, I was exasperated a little bit, because I figured in the sixth grade, at least you knew your multiplication tables, you knew some of those things. So that Sunday, this happened on a Saturday. That Sunday, I went up to church, which my wife usually and I go to church most every Sunday. Of course, lately we haven't because of her. But I cornered the superintendent after church. We were walking down the walk there, and I says, Mr. Lincoln, I says, what the hell are you teaching these kids in school? And he says, what's your problem? So I told him. Well, he says, of course, they haven't gotten into decimals. I said, decimals? I said, there's nothing to do with decimals. I said, this is ridiculous. And that was the answer I got out of him. And the owner says, well, he says, we're trying to straighten some of these things out. Well, I says, I think you better. I said, I'd like to know what the hell you're teaching these kids. Well, that went on. Well, a few days afterwards, I went up here at the garage. Here was a junior in high school. He was sitting there by the register, and he was working on his fingers. And I said, what's your problem? He says, I'm multiplying 9 times 9. I says, 81. He looked at me, he says, how in the hell do you know that? I said, hell, I remember those. I had memorized those things back when I was in the grades, early grades. I said, don't they teach you people anything? Oh, no, they don't teach us anything like that. And I don't give a damn how good a building you can build. You can build a castle, you can build anything for them, but it depends a lot on the child, the parents, and the teacher. And I don't know if I can lay it against the teacher, because I think you've got some good teachers. But either the parents are to blame, or the child doesn't want to take, concentrate or do any of these things. And I think this is the trouble with the situation you've got in the education. You're not teaching the basics. And we're paying a hell of a bill. And we're not getting results.
Well, you were just saying about building, you know, and mathematics and so forth. But in the old days, you didn't have to be an architect either to build.
No, because I can remember in the old days, down here at the schoolhouse, we had rows of seats and aisles. I think there was two seats on here, and then there'd be an aisle, and then another two seats, and that sort of thing. And when the teacher asked for a class to come up there, maybe it might be in mathematics or something, you always had the big blackboards up front. And you'd come up and you'd sit in the seat up front by the teacher, and she would explain things and be the blackboard and that. And of course, another thing too, if the upper grades were up there, of course the lower grades back there, but you were bound to listen to what was going on the blackboard. And observing. And then they would have their class maybe for, you know, 15 or 20 minutes, and then she would expel them, and they'd go back to seats, and then there'd be the next class that would come up, you see. And then she would go on, maybe it might be reading or something like that, or spelling. And I'm not so sure, but maybe they had a better education. I think nowadays the problem, I've read somewhere in the industries, that now the industries have to educate the kids before they really give them a job, because they don't have it. They don't have that background. The old barn buildings, they'd make the sides and the ends, and so on and so forth, the carpenters would. And then when it come with the barn raising, all they did was take long poles and they'd get the whole neighborhood. Everybody would come down and we'd have the barn raising. And of course, before the day was over, the barn was pretty near all built. Because they'd put up the sides and then the ends, and then they put them together, and then they'd start putting the rafters on. And then after that, what the carpenters then would take over and, you know, do the roofing. They used to put the beer out, and they had the hard cider and a few other things like that, and the women used to furnish the food and things. They'd have a regular picnic at noontime and feed all the help, and they worked together. It's true.
When was this place built?
That is a good question. I have an idea. I know David Simon was the first owner of the place. Of course, then it changed hands from one to another to
and
one
that
another.
Was when?
Around 1800. I have an idea the place was built shortly after 1800, part of it. Because this house, part of it is plank partition, 2.5-inch thick plank. I didn't realize it either till I had a company come here to insulate the place. So they took a few clapboards off, and they went up there with a 3-inch hole, and they bored right into the room. And the guy come down off the ladder, and he says, "Mr. Wally says we can't insulate this place because this is no place to put the insulation." So what it was just simply 2.5-inch thick plank with lath on it and plastered inside, and paper and the clapboards on the outside. That's all about. This is why it was very difficult. I've had aluminum siding put on here years ago, about 3 years, I couldn't keep paint on this thing. It stopped peeling because you see the moisture from the house inside, you know, working the paint would all chip off. And this is why I put the aluminum siding on. And that has been a big help too. And then part of the place is on this side, it's what they call lath and plaster and back plastered. And so I have an idea that that section of the house was built first. Now when, I don't know, I've tried to find out, but I can't find out. But I'm pretty sure it was shortly after 1800. And then this other place over here was part of, at one time, the land was part of this place because this is made up of two lots, lot 125 and lot 126. And the lot lines are from the Gaylord line to my place, and the Newtons is from Newtons and Paul's. So the lot line between Newtons and mine is not a lot line. You see, they did it often in kind of in squares, like years ago. Probably if you looked up in the Wakefield history, you could see on the map how that was broken up and sold off. I don't know. Of course, General Waite eventually owned the whole town, because he was paid off because he was a revolutionary soldier. And he was a general. And he, in those days, they paid him off in land. And I never knew just how it was handled after that, whether he sold off parcels or whether later on they come in and they divided it up into lots. I don't know. I've oftentimes wondered just how that was done.
Well, I was interested in that the barn is connected.
Mm-hmm.
You don't see that too often. Well, at least over our way in the Champlain Valley, you seldom see that.
Mm-hmm.
As you get closer to New Hampshire, you see it more often.
Yeah.
And I was interested to know if you knew anything about that, or was it your... in your family when you connected them, or?
No, that was connected. I have a picture of years ago of my grandfather and grandmother out here in the yard, and the buildings were about the same. The only thing is, my father did raise this barn. He raised it, I think 2 or 3 feet. Because it's a little different now where the barns joined together, I noticed. This barn seems to be up a little higher than it used to be. But the general layout is the same. And that used to be where the garage is, used to be all open for carriages and things like that. This main part of the house was here. Which I'm pretty sure the picture was taken very shortly after he bought the place, because the only way I can go at it, we have two big maple trees. One of them went down here a couple of years ago, fell down. And those trees were little tiny trees. And then I went to work, and when that tree fell, I counted the rings. And I think it was about 160 rings. So that would bring it back pretty well to my grandfather's time. And viewing the picture and viewing that, I think the picture was taken very shortly after he bought the place. And that's the only thing I can go on.
That's interesting. Were there many barns attached to the houses? Around here?
Well, there used to be quite a few. Of course, some of them have taken them down.
Yeah, yeah.
But this place originally it's about the same as it was back at that time.
And was this the original kitchen here?
No, I think originally this porch that's out here went up to this door.
Uh-huh.
Because I know there's another, when I put a register in years and years ago, there was two floors. So I'm pretty sure that probably, now what this room was, might have been a back room or something, because my grandfather built the dining room, put the dining room on, and he also put the sheds on out back, because you can tell because it's, they're made of two before. The rest of the building is hewed timbers, big hewed timbers. If you went in the garage and you look up the garage, you can see they're all hewed timbers, and the same thing's in the barn, wooden pinned. So really, it's pretty near the main buildings these are. Of course, we have a well out here that was dug, it goes down about, well, I guess about 14 or 16 feet. And I see it in down cellar where there was some lead pipe that come in, they cut it off. So I assume probably they had a kitchen in this part here with a pump. In fact, I've got two of those old pumps, you know, that used to go up here. They're up there in the attic. I'd hate awfully to take, to move out of this place. I've got so damn much junk here, honest and truly. It's my niece told me, I says, there's something. I said, you're going to have a hell of a mess to clean out there. And she says, don't you throw one thing away. I want to know what's there. So I think she's going to have one hell of a good time.
Did she grow up here, or?
Well, her father, of course, was born here, and then, of course, he was he went to MIT.
This is your brother.
Yeah, he lives down below here, and he graduated from that, and then he went out to Missouri College, and he was head of the electrical engineering in Missouri College. He was a professor out there. And that's where they were living, and that's where she was born, I think. I don't know if she was born in Missouri or just where, for sure. But anyway, her brother and she was born there. And then I had one other brother that worked, was a organic chemistry in Princeton University. And he did a lot of medical research. And then my other brother, oldest brother, went to work for General Motors. And he was a second-hand engineer in the frigid air department out in Dayton, Ohio. So they all had good positions. And somebody says, well, they all graduated, and of course they got the degree, and they asked me what my degree was, and I said, PDF. He says, what the hell does that stand for? I says, Pa Damn Fool. So...
Making a farm go is no foolery.
Well, anyway, I guess I fared out about as well as the rest of them. But anyway, they had good positions. They did well.
When did you stop farming?
In 1968. I had to give it up because I was having a lot of back trouble. In fact, I have a little now. I have to be pretty careful. And answer I got from the doctor at that time, he said, you're going to have to get off that tractor and milking and stop milking cows, or else, he says, you're going to be crippled for life if you don't. So I took his advice.
Was it a hard piece of advice to take?
Well, I'll tell you, it was hard to see the cattle go. I told them when they took it, they'd take the cattle out, but I sold the whole herd to a fellow over on the west side of the state. And I sold my milkers. And I said, well, when you come to get them, I said, I'm not going to help you because I don't want to be around. And so he took them. And I know several years afterwards, oh, I guess about 10 years afterwards, I saw this guy and asked him. I said, well, I suppose most all the cattle that you bought for me, I said, are pretty near gone. He says, no. He said, they were a wonderful herd. He said, I've had quite a lot of them left. So I guess he was satisfied with them. And then the next year, I sold off my young cattle. And in the meantime, of course, I had been an agent for the insurance company down there, the cooperative. And then I went into a business of selling travel trailers. I sold them for 10 years. And, well, here's a good example. I went over to Northfield Bank. Of course, I didn't have very much money. And I went over to Northfield Bank. Of course, I knew Richard Gaylord, who was the president of the Northfield Bank. And he was born right up here in the next place above here, because this is the Gaylord place. I told Richard, I said, Richard, I want to borrow so much money, quite a few $1,000s. Because I said, I've got to buy these things, and I've got to pay for them when they come. And I said, I'm going into a little different business. Well, I'm getting my cart before the horse a little bit. How I happened to go into it, I went out to California, because Elsie's brother and sister were out there. It was in 63. And we went to the Sacramento Fair, and there they were selling trailers and campers and things like that. I got quite interested. So I told my wife, coming back on the plane, I said, I think we ought to have one of those. I think it would be nice to travel around in. And I says, I don't know how you feel about it. Yeah, she was okay, so fine. So I went around and went around some of the dealers, and I wasn't too satisfied in talking with them and getting results. They didn't act to me as if they wanted to sell anything. And finally I come home and kind of discussed it, and I told my wife, I said, you know, I think I go into business. Well, that was all right. She was willing. So as I say, I went over to the bank. And I told Richard, I says, well, I says, probably you want an arm and a leg. No, no. He says, I know you. Well, I says, what kind of a deal can we make? Well, he says, we'll give you a 6 months loan. And in 6 months, he says, you pay us the interest. And if you can, pay something on the principal. And he says, that'll be fine. And he says, if you can't, we'll renew it. And we'll keep doing it that way. I said, Richard, do you want to take that kind of chance? He said, I said, maybe I'm stupid going into something like this. No, he says, nothing ventured, nothing done. So that's how I started in the trailer business. And that's the way I did. And I, for a couple of years, it was kind of tough there because I wasn't known too much. And I hadn't advertised too much, as much as I should. And then finally, after that, the third and fourth year, then things began to break for me.
Did you do it right from here?
Yeah, I did it right here. I had this yard full of trailers out here, campers. It wasn't very good looking, I'll admit. But anyway, I had a lot of fun and meeting people and doing things. And usually, most of these trailers that come in here, they bring them in on a flatbed. It depends on the size, two or three trailers at a time, and of course you always had to pay for them. And when we unloaded them, they'd leave, and my wife and I would go out and we'd take the vacuum cleaner, we'd clean them all out, because they're always full of chinkins, shavings. They never clean them out, and especially in the cupboards and traces like that, and there'd be metal chinkins, and oh boy, I'll tell you, sometimes it'd be an awful mess. And then we put something down on the floor, you know, to so people could walk in and see them. And I had two people come back. In all the 10 years that I sold trailers, I always checked them out very thoroughly to see if everything was working. And I never had but two people that ever brought their trailers back. And I know one fellow in particular, Mr. Lord, out here, Barry, he bought a trailer from me. And I checked it all out. Everything worked fine, the refrigerator and everything. And when he got home, he couldn't start his refrigerator. And he says, Mr. Wallace, he said, I don't think you checked it. I said, yes, I did. But I says, you bring it back. I says, I know what the trouble is. So I just simply took the refrigerator out, tightened up on the thermocouple a little bit, because you're supposed to have that a little more than finger tight, but not too tight. It has to be just about right. And I fixed that, put the refrigerator, worked everything on it. But I never had any trouble with anybody. Never.
It's quite a record.
In the 10 years that I had it. And then when it comes 74, and that gas scare, I told my wife, I said, we're just going to dispose of things. Because I said, I don't know, I don't like the looks of things. So I dropped the price right down and got rid of the whole business. And I did service work after that. And like working on refrigerators and heaters and things. And I've done that right up until recently in the last few years. I've helped people out. Doing that.
Well, it sounds to me like you got a pretty good education on the farm.
A practical education.
So that you could do something like that.
That's right.
I mean, you had to know how to
That's right.
All kinds of things.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And you must have just absorbed that from the time you were a kid.
Well, of course, a lot of it, I got a lot of information from the companies, of course, that made these things.
Mm-hmm.
To know as to how to repair and so on. And I'd study that. Wherever there's problems, I would study those things. I got along pretty good. In fact, here a few years ago, a couple of years ago, a fellow brought in a heater, and he couldn't, the pilot wouldn't stay on. The pilot would stay on until the main burner would come on. And when the main burner came on, the pilot would go off, and then, of course, the main burner would go off. And I told him, well, I should bring it here. And in fact, he broke the housing to his motor, so I had to fix that. And so I fixed that. And I had quite a time with that thing, and I couldn't figure it out. And finally, I took out the control and looked at it. And I noticed a little water come out of it. So I took and blew the thing all out, cleaned it all out, good shape, put it back in, and everything worked perfect. So evidently there was much condensation within the control so that it was operating right. And a few little things like that, you know. The fellow had taken it to other dealers, and they said they couldn't do anything. But I'm not one to give up. I like to know what does it. I'm sure I spent a lot more time than I ever got paid for. But anyway, I had the satisfaction.
Well, I think that's something else that maybe comes from farming. Today, everybody's concerned with the amount of time, and time is money.
Yeah.
And in farming, you couldn't, or you weren't, that concerned with that particular attitude.
Mm-hmm. Well, maybe my bringing up was a little different than it is today. Sometimes people, you know, just throw up their hands and that's it. They don't want to put the time in, they don't want to bother with it. Wanted me to come up and talk to some of the students. They didn't give us a fourth or fifth and sixth grade and talk about some of the old times. I don't think the kids realized what they were like. And I think she got a kind of an eye-opener too on things.
Well, the changes you've seen in your lifetime are remarkable.
I think the changes, I think in this country the biggest change is really from starting from World War I right up to today. Science has improved tremendously. Medicine has improved tremendously. I think this is really a big change.